Segarra and Hooray for the Riff Raff performing their song Palante at Democracy Now's 30th anniversary on Monday at the historic Riverside Church here in New York. To watch the full event, go to democracynow.org. It included Angela Davis, Bruce Springsteen, Michael Stipe, Aaron Dessner, Masab Abu-Toha, V, Juan Gonzalez, Nermeen Sheikh, and more. Check it out at democracynow.org. And the film about Democracy Now's 30 years is opening in New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and more. You can check it all out, stealthisstory.org. We will be doing Q&As at all the theaters. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Love KBOO Community Radio and its mission? Step up and apply to join the board of directors. KBOO's board leads the station, shaping its future, representing member voices, safeguarding its financial health, and sustaining the independence of community radio. Every KBOO member can run for the board, and we especially encourage BIPOC members to apply. Want to learn more? Join an upcoming board information session held online via video conference from now through June. More information and meeting times can be found at kboo.fm/recruitment26.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Energy Trust of Oregon, empowering people throughout the region with energy-efficient solutions that can improve the comfort and safety of homes, businesses, and lives. More info at energytrust.org. Energy Trust of Oregon.
Land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim.
Welcome to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I am your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield. This week, first up, Christian nationalism, evangelicalism. Some might say that it's what's destroying our nation, but are we actually ready to sit with how much it actually defines our nation? Jared Stacy, a former evangelical pastor and author of the newly released book Reality in Ruins, How Conspiracy Theory Became an American Evangelical Crisis, joins the show to talk about the history and the present of this entwined relationship between the U.S. and evangelicalism, how conspiracy theories become gospel, and how, if we want to address the fallout from this tangle, theological intervention is necessary. Next up, Chief of Advocacy at Freedom of the Press Foundation, Seth Stern, comes back on the program to dig into some of the most recent and egregious threats to the First Amendment, from classifying black clothing as criminal activity to journalistic malpractice in apocalyptic times. All of that and more is coming up this week on Project Censored.
Citizens, and the times for the master.
Welcome to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio, and I am your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield, and here's some of the news that didn't make the news for the week of March 23rd, 2026. The apocalyptic war against Iran continues, and as Breakthrough News reported this past week, contrary to U.S. media claims, Iran's firepower is not exhausted, and Iran continues to fight back with a force that U.S. officials apparently didn't seem ready for. For its part, the Pentagon has been making use of AI via both Palantir and Anthropic to, quote, speed up the kill chain. The process of identifying, approving, and striking targets, automating human-made targeting decisions in ways which, as expert in modern warfare Craig Jones noted, opens up all kinds of problematic legal, ethical, and political questions. Yeah, no kidding. Meanwhile, the Dow hit a record low for the year, with oil surging to $115 per barrel, and the International Maritime Organization reports that roughly 3,200 vessels are confined in the Gulf of Hormuz due to the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, including around 450 oil and gas tankers, 150 container ships, and 200 bulk carriers. Thousands of crew members are facing worsening conditions, with reports of rapidly dwindling food and water supplies. Meanwhile, as reported by Middle East Eye, Israeli strikes on Lebanon leave a classroom of children, about 30, dead or wounded every day. Aid to Gaza has plunged by 80% since the war on Iran began, according to latest figures from an Israeli coordination center reported on by Haaretz, with deliveries falling sharply from pre-war levels and fewer than 400 trucks entering in recent days. The Conflict and Environment Observatory released an updated analysis on the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, pointing to toxic runoff, extreme acid rain, heavy marine pollution, oil and gas fires, all of which have grave ecological consequences that will be felt for decades to come. In reporting by the Freedom of the Press Foundation's Lauren Harper, Trump is looking to build a massive centralized government database containing intimate details about every resident of this country, fully searchable by AI. Hey, what could go wrong? In reporting by LA Taco, the youngest known ICE detainee has died. 19-year-old Royer Perez Jimenez, an indigenous Mayan teen from Chiapas, died of a, quote, presumed suicide on March 16th at the Glades County Detention Center in Moorhaven, Florida. Compared to the same period last year, the death rate in ICE custody has tripled. As data analyst and guest of the show, Dr. Austin Coker, noted in a recent post, since the beginning of the second Trump administration, 41 people have died in ICE detention. 12 of those deaths have occurred since January 1st, a rate of roughly one every 6 days. That's some of the news that didn't make the news for the week of March 23rd, 2026. And now, on to this week's program. Thanks, everyone, for joining us at the Project Censored radio show. I'm your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield, and I'm very glad right now to be joined by Jared Stacey, PhD, who is a theologian and ethicist and former pastor to evangelical churches in New Orleans and the Washington, D.C. metro area. He received a PhD in moral and practical theology from the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. His research focuses on the intersection of theology and politics, specifically on ethics, extremism, conspiracy theory, and U.S. evangelicalism. Jared's work and his story have been featured on platforms like Time, NPR, NBC News, the BBC, and Christianity Today, and the new book, Reality in Ruins: How Conspiracy Theory Became an American Evangelical Crisis. It's a descriptive and prescriptive book about evangelicalism in the U.S., which features your story personally. Jared, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Eleanor, thank you so much for having me on. I'm really, really pleased to be here. This is going to be a good conversation.
I feel like it is too.
Yeah, lots of time.
Yes. I mean, you literally wrote a book about this. So like, y'all, we're not going to get to everything. But with right. that, I'm going to try here. I want to first dig into the history of what you call this renaissance of paranoia. Because on this show, very frequently, we use history to orient ourselves in the present. And I don't usually read this long of a quote, but I do think it's necessary to dig into this fully in order to frame my question. So forgive me, everyone, for this reading rainbow moment that I'm about to have here. You write in the book, quote, "The rise of conspiracy theory that we are experiencing today is inseparable from the history of evangelicalism in America. There's no period of so-called evangelical history when a segment of evangelicals is not trafficking in conspiracy theory." And we've seen how these conspiracy theories don't often originate with the evangelicals themselves. They emerge from the anxieties and identities that are latent in the American experiment. Whether maintaining the institution of slavery or the creation of Jim Crow in the wake of reconciling Northern and Southern whites, or fears over immigrants and communist infiltration, or claims of a pervasive deep state, these suspicions are not unique to Christians. As these historical episodes show, the totality at the heart of evangelicalism isn't just the Christian story, is it? It contains a story, a myth of America, end quote. I say all that because I think one of the points of the book that I found so powerful and important to not miss is that this isn't just about Christians. It's about America and how we can't really separate the two, no matter how elegantly we talk about the separation of church and state. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this history of a nation that is also the history of evangelicalism.
Yeah, no, I think that this really gets to the heart of the book, and this is one of the main driving historical claims all the way through. You know, we are really locked in a moment of decision, but also disruption, right? Like the claim America is a Christian nation is fueling a certain sort of politics and fueling the seizure of democratic machinery. You may even say like the hollowing out, right, of democracy based on this really powerful claim that certain sort of people are the proper heirs of the United States. There's always so many ways that evangelicals, we can try to justify this by sort of saying, well, you know, hey, we're just people who want to take the Bible seriously. We're trying to contribute to communities. But when that translates into policy, when that translates into beliefs about what America should be, which is a moral and political claim, these stories are not just stories. They're guiding and shaping an ought, a moral ought in the political. And this is how I experience, though. When you want to criticize someone, you say, well, they're political. But when it's about time to talk about your politics as an evangelical, you say, this is moral. This is God's way. Well, in the book, I talk about how this myth of America is sort of baked into and inseparable from the Christian story, that saying certain things about America actually flies in the face, and you get coded as, well, this person's maybe theologically suspect. The Christian faith is a little bit, oh, I don't know if we should trust this person. And I heard from someone recently who said, you know, your work is attacking Christians and their love for America. And I had to kind of stop and like sit with that statement and say, well, in many ways, that's where the pressure belongs. The only caveat is that I'm not really attacking people. But the idea is, so insofar as people identify themselves with these stories, their identity is bound up in the narrative. That sort of identification is what this work is designed to put pressure on, to subvert. And so if people feel attacked, like that's not the intention, but that's the pressure. And that's what I felt. That's what I experienced. Because I called white Christian nationalism Christianity. I called it biblical Christian faith. I underwent this depressurizing. But there's a myth of America, and we see this every time the police violence or racial violence, these long storied parts of American history kind of flare up. That story that is sustained about America has theological charge to it. And I'm trying to get at that in the book and kind of open this up, because normal activisms of like protecting and preserving democratic machinery doesn't touch the myth, doesn't touch the story.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that there's only so much, you know, there's only so much like logic and reason that we can use to apply to this if people, and I want to get to this later, the aspect of storytelling. But first, I want to further get into like more pushing us towards the present here, this perceived threat to U.S. empire as threats to the church as well. And like you said that, you know, one of your friends had said that this was what you were doing. You were attacking America and Christianity. And, you know, right now you've got people saying we're in a holy war in the Middle East, which is actually not anything new. W. Bush said the same thing. Hegseth says the war on Iran is part of God's divine plan, foretold by the Book of Revelation. You know, you got people saying, if you say no to Trump, you say no to God, et cetera, et cetera. This paranoia that somehow those with the most power are the most persecuted, the most oppressed. Yep. How does this story keep gaining traction? Like, how does this lunacy maintain its stranglehold on our body politic, that the people with the most power are somehow the most oppressed and persecuted?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I was raised in that pressurized environment. I was raised where that story was sort of reflexively what I was taught about the world and about my place in it. As a kid in youth group, right? So that's what they, you know, call the time that teenagers kind of spend in the church youth group. And the idea of being persecuted, the idea that your faith, that you were being incubated in the church to go out to a world that in some cases, like, really wanted you dead. And that America was heading in a direction where that reality at home domestically would render itself, like, true and real. When we talk about Hegseth, when we talk about, you know, some of this rhetoric would be right at home in the 11th century, the 10th century, going up to the Crusades, right? This idea that participating in divine violence is somehow on that path of salvation, right? Like, this is ancient rhetoric. And I think, just to say two things to listeners, first, a lot of this does have to do with the church's reception of Revelation, the book of Revelation. And there's a very recent reading of the book of Revelation that emerged out of the pressures of the Confederacy and the Civil War, out of the need to sort of generate a theory of history that could stand up to the pressures of modernity. I'm talking about the rapture, dispensationalism, this idea, this theological system that is very new, very recent, has really no backing or support across 2,000 years of church history up until the last 100. But it's diffused itself through books, novels like Left Behind, what people consume. And basically what it propagates is this: if you want to take the mid-20th century fear of totalitarianism and bake that into a reading of Revelation where Christians are the ones who are going to be persecuted, and that if you can just apply the code of Revelation and biblical prophecy to geopolitical events, not only can you understand history, but maybe you can engineer it. Maybe you know better than most what a certain nation represents. And this goes back to Reagan. This goes back to H.W. Bush, advisors, evangelical advisors telling them this nation in the book of Ezekiel represents the European Union, or represents Russia. So when this gets into, you know, the Secretary of Defense, when this gets into our government, there is no, like, pastoral intervention possible in those places. The diffusion of this inverted reading of Revelation, let's call it that. Like, Revelation was originally written by a community of ostracized, marginalized Christians in the middle of the Roman Empire who were kicked out of their synagogue and excluded from participation in Roman society, who were trying to grapple with, how do we live? How do we continue on as subversive, marginalized community? But anytime, and this isn't my insight, but anytime you read Revelation while occupying positions of political power, you're going to come to the wrong conclusion every time. Every time. And the way that conclusion issues in terms of policy, in terms of concrete decision making, is that you very much begin to think of Jesus as a military leader. It fuels militarism, even though the symbolic language of Revelation is more about the damage that militarism and empire causes to the church. It really just creates this inverted reading that is able to endorse all sorts of expansionary imperialist wars, power grabs, all of those sorts of things. But I think at its root, this is from a theological perspective, like, at its root, if we really want to, almost in a Star Wars way, like, find that thermal exhaust port that, you know, ends up destroying the Death Star here, a lot of this is distinctly theological. And that's what's so incredibly frustrating, I think, to so many who use every means at our disposal as citizens, right, to fill democratic machinery with safeguards against this sort of ideology, to elect leaders who represent us, all of these things. But the pervasive power of this story is such that the theological intervention is essential. That's not saying that it's ultimate or that it's the only sort of intervention that we can make. But oftentimes, right, the insistence on the separation of church and state has unfortunately sort of denied the necessary theological interventions that take place. So let me just end with this by saying, to respond to Christian nationalists, avowed Christian nationalists who think America is their country to rule, their morality to impose, to state to them, what about the separation of church and state? Or to state that Christian nationalism isn't really Christianity, none of that is helpful, because they don't care about the separation of church and state like a normal guided American principle would look at it. And secondly, they see themselves as Christians. Irrespective of like what you, I, anyone else would say, they see themselves as Christians. January 6th was a prayer rally too. It was a Christian event. And so, you know, when you look at the ways that this ideology, this theology, it's all baked in. We need theological intervention as a seat at the table, right? Not just at the level of activism either. That too, but the book is really gesturing towards this very fundamental, primal, like we're reading the Bible in our hands is justifying what we want to do. And we can't count on non-Christians to do that work for us. Like, this is an internal job with external consequences. And your listeners know this because they're living under that shadow and under that threat.
Right. And I like that in your, and I think it was the introduction you wrote, if you're trying to win, you've already lost. And right. I think that that's another thing that we talk about on the show a lot is that like your goal in these political spaces should not be to try to win or a debate or something. Mm-hmm. And as an organizer, I talk very much about meeting people where they're at. And if they're at a space where this is what they believe, you just telling them that they're idiots is not going to, that's right. not helping.
Right.
And I want to kind of get into a little bit of this space, because I'm not Christian, but I grew up in the South and was surrounded by evangelicalism and, you know, Christianity, and was the only Jewish kid at my school. And I want to try to like tease at this a little bit and poke at it a little bit of why specifically like the conspiracies in this Christianity go well together. And one of the things that I was reading from your book was the, you know, replacing fear with certainty, which I feel is why a lot of people go to religion or find religion comfortable. Yeah. You know, that you're standing at this gaping chasm of uncertainty and the arbitrariness of the universe and our place in it. But, and then there's God, at least in this right. Christian sense, is like the bumpers on the bowling lane. Like, don't worry, you can't fall into this abyss of the unknown because someone is watching you, someone's watching out for you and has all the answers. And like you write in the book, quote, the pandemic was weeks old, knowledge was scarce, but somehow the people I served already had the answers. And you also write, quote, Christian knowledge is taken to be anything and everything that dissents from the facts as presented by non-Christians. There's no common world possible here with such blatant dismissal of fact. There's only the antagonism of Christian versus non-Christian, end quote. Yep. And so there's almost like this pride in not knowing that is perceived by them as this pride in knowing things that you don't know, like, hey, I have the inside scoop. And it's based on nothing really but fluff and hot air, and that doesn't matter because really that's a lot of what, you know, certain kinds of faith is, believing in something without ever having to have proof of it. And so I'm wondering, could you talk a little bit to this idea of like, is this why this like certain kinds of religion or Christianity work well with conspiracy? Because there is this feeling like, oh, I don't need proof, I just yeah. know it inherently.
Yeah, so I think this is the pressure that is carried all the way through the book. Like, this is the right question. This is the tension. Because I hear it all the time. Like, well, of course, evangelicals, again, I'm my people. Like, I grew up in these spaces, right? I'm going to keep saying that. Like, you, and I'm still a practicing Christian, right? So I've heard it. You people believe in fairy tales. Like, of course you believe in XYZ, and insert whatever conspiracy theory you want to have. There's so many different directions to take this, but I want to talk about two. And one is the way that pastoring in America, pastoral ministry, has been expanded as an authority figure, right? So if you look at the way that the figure of pastor, when you look at the roles that this person embodies in non-denominational, like mega church style leadership, that's a very distinctly 21st century idea. And the authority that comes with that, pastoral authority is no longer in matters of the ultimate, which I would say, you know, life, death, and resurrection. Like that's a very Christian claim, being bedside with people, ministering the faith to them. But suddenly when pastoring involves institutional leadership, involves finance, involves all of these things, what's happened in this crisis of pastoral ministry is that the authority that is usually reserved for the pastoral role gets stretched epistemologically over so many disciplines that, you know, the scientific skepticism, all of this sorts of things, that pastoring has come to embody a much wider authority than what it's really designed to be. And I say that as one who was trained in these schools. I say that as one who was a pastor. The second thing, when we're looking at the ways in which all of the ways that our collective body, body politic, relies on story to arrive at some sort of common will for political action. The accusation or the criticism that Christians believe in fairy tales, you know, I grew up in a Christianity that tried to prove itself by the terms of rational science that were imposed on it, right? So I grew up believing that the question of my faith was whether or not historically Jesus of Nazareth died on the cross. Like that event may be suspect, but if I could like maybe go and witness it, I would believe, right? There's this idea that we've inside Christianity have maybe lost the sense of what faith actually is. And to follow that up with this claim that, well, you believe in fantasy. Here's the thing. It is scandalous. Like what the Christian faith actually claims about Jesus of Nazareth is, and that's where the pressure belongs. And I make a point in the book, and I'll continue to make it, that the veracity, like the trustworthiness and the intelligibility and the credibility of that claim cannot be satisfied by the rational criteria of science and history. It just can't. It can't be. What I'm trying to do in the book is articulate ways that Christians can remain Christian without giving themselves over to the sorts of suspicion that make conspiracy just part of the general casserole that is faith. And whether or not that it's accomplished, is it remains to be seen. But the argument I'm trying to make is sort of inverting the Christian posture to say, we have the inside scoop on everything. We know the true story of the world. Therefore, we know what's going on in the room that we can't be in. No. I quote in the book, a theologian, Brian Brock, who says, the only thing that the church knows that the world doesn't is who sustains it, right? So the questions of climate change, questions of military action, Christians don't have the purview on that. We don't have the inside edge. We have a totally different story of interpreting some of these things, but that doesn't mean we predict it. It doesn't mean we know the material facts better than anyone else. So I'm trying to, in some ways, create a more stable posture that is actually wildly untrustworthy when it comes to political action, because suddenly now evangelicals, I'm arguing, shouldn't be or can't be the people who know just reflexively that we actually have to dialogue with fellow citizens. We actually have to do the work of making policy. We actually have to ask ourselves, well, is 200 years of unrestrained capitalism changing our climate? Rather than just saying, the Bible says that Jesus is going to come back. So yeah, we can support fossil fuels, right? All of that little stuff baked into there, it gets justified not by fact-checking activisms. It just gets justified by a Christian story. That's what I'm trying to get after.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think there's also like so much nuance here, and the nuance between storytelling and mythologizing, which all cultures do. And there's this really great, I actually have it on a cup. There's this podcast called Our Fake History. And one of the taglines is, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it's not real. And I mean, we all feel that, right? All cultures have myths. And even if you consider yourself an atheist, you have some beliefs that are just based on your gut feeling. Well, right. That's not quote unquote real, but it doesn't mean that it's not real to you and doesn't dictate how you move through the world. So I think there's a lot of nuance here. And I want to get into that a little bit, because we have something, Rebecca Solnit calls it a storytelling crisis, right? And we have a storytelling crisis, which is not that the problem isn't that we tell stories. We've always told stories as human beings, right? Yep. We've scribbled them on cave walls. Like, so I think there's sometimes this push to just say, okay, we'll just do away with all myths and storytelling. And, you know, we just need to get out of that headspace because it's ruining the way we interact with the world, which is tacitly false, because we've always told these stories, right? You know, not necessarily to blur the line between what's real and not, but also to in a way to process what's real, right? In order to deal with it. And I think the problem isn't that we tell stories, it's that we tell one story, right? Like as Nietzsche put it, you have your way and I have mine, but as for the right way, it does not exist. So yeah. We should not seek to end myth-making or get rid of any kind of supernatural or spiritual storytelling. It's something so human, but rather we should be able to make the distinction between what is myth and what is not, and hold many stories. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this, like this aspect of, well, that just the one story versus the many stories. And even inside of the Bible, there are many stories, there are contradictions, there are different ways. And I'm wondering, how do you see that as a former evangelical, and how can we embrace this multitude of storytelling as opposed to saying, okay, we're just not going to do stories anymore?
Right. Yeah. So like you're framing this, the option is, and I talk about it in the book, like this sort of bare reality where all we have is facts. And I hear it all the time. You know, I believe in facts. And the issue with that, the challenge with that is that, well, what is sorting your facts as like viable or plausible or valuable, right? There is, and Stanley Hauerwas has this quip of saying, you know, that sort of bare reality, that sort of secular existence is still telling a story, which is that there is no story. That's a story. And that sort of bare reality is not really in vogue the way it used to be maybe 20 years ago. And so I think rather than the antagonism that we're so familiar with, and especially that evangelicals and the apologetics industry is so very profitable for framing disagreement as, and I use this language in the book, as totality. But when we adjust for the politic of plurality and democracy, first off, democracy is requires a commitment to diversity. It requires a willingness to lose. If you can't persuade, that's it. But the commonality that we all experience, I'm learning in my work now as a chaplain, which is not a Christian position, right, to utilize this language of encounter and discovery. Now, the language of discovery is really difficult because as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, right, like colonialism just kind of saturates the air the way that we talk about these things. So using the language of discovery can be very difficult. But when we talk about discovery in terms of anticipation, not coercion, encounter in terms of curiosity, not to civilize another person, but to really encounter them. I think there are Christian ways that integrates with what I currently believe. But I also think that there's an offer on there for anyone who's not a Christian to say, yeah, like these are maybe some ways that we can think about all of our stories, the ways that we view the world. They all have a spot of encounter where we're learning from each other and learning these values, learning what orients us. And unfortunately, that colonial impulse that has driven a lot of Christianity in the West for the last 300 to 400 to maybe 800 years, depending on who you talk to, it shuts down that encounter. It becomes a coercive encounter. It becomes about conquest.
And I like in your book, you also talk about this, the good suspicion, the ability, yeah, perhaps even mandate, I would say, because I view it as a mandate of mine that to admit when I don't know, right?
Yeah.
And I think that this is also something that can feel very scary, especially when you as you pointed out, when we're like the answers are just supposed to exist and you're just supposed to have all of them and they're all in the Bible or they're it just the knowledge, yeah, is not something that you have to work for. It's not something that needs to be shared or debated with respect. It is just, yeah, something that you have. And I feel like also at the this is something that I've seen a lot in the South too, where I grew up and I've done a lot of work, is that there's just like a very deep loss of pride, a very deep disconnect from community that is constructed through capitalism and colonialism, a disconnect from place, from nature. And in its stead, we put a totally denaturalized God, we put guns and conspiracies and all of the cliches, right?
Yeah.
And I, just as the goal should not be to try to eradicate any religion or anyone's beliefs, this question, which I'm going to wrap up with, is a very difficult question. How do you separate that such a church from such a state? How do you take things that are so entwined but so toxic to the earth, you know, meeting out genocides and ecocides in the name of, yeah, God and power? I mean, you write in your book, quote, imagine, if you will, the church in America as a place that reflects the God who, as Peter proclaimed in Acts, shows no favoritism. It would be a community of and for the poor, the marginalized, and the exercised, end quote. And there already are those churches. You know, I've seen them, I've been in them, I've been invited into them, but they are not the American church that, as you write in your book. And at what point in this do you say that we can't reform this, that perhaps this iteration, yeah, of a church or this iteration of a nation state that was founded on such violence and terror cannot be taken into the future if we are to have a future?
I don't know if I have anything to add to that. You articulated it very well. And I think that's the natural outcome of actually what I'm getting at. But I think commonly and collectively, insofar as evangelicals continue to treat, for example, a political order like the nation state as something given, as something God ordained, or capitalism as just freedom, right? I mean, I didn't have a category for economic practice until much later in life. And what I learned was that when I was talking about freedom as a very ideologically idealistic, you know, 20 something at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, when I was talking about freedom, I was talking about capitalism. So I think the dispossession of the givenness for a lot of these things, which is truly a revolutionary impulse, I think, we come face to face with this more deep question, are we fated? Or is the future something that we can receive? And that's one of the major kind of points that I pair with that idea of good suspicion, is that what if reality is not something that we need to construct or, and more importantly, protect? That reality might be something that we receive. And for those who are not Christians, that I think that still works, especially when we say, like, we're not fated here. Like, we don't have to just go along with what's being handed down to us. There can be small acts of resistance and flourishing and shared humanity. But I think it also, in order for this to make sense, it requires us to expand the timeline of our lives. Like, I'm very quickly approaching the point of, yep, the damage, drinking the dregs, all of this is maybe the work of our lifetime. And I don't know what's going to come after that. But this very neoliberal notion of like, oh, this is just a bump in the road. We're going to recover. The market's going to go back up. Keep your Roth. We're not promised that, are we? And being dispossessed from that sort of illusion of progress, I think may actually push us to some more radical ways of living that might surprise us. And I think in some ways, if people want someone to read about this, I'm very much influenced by Camus on this point and his posture and his way of being in the world and acts of rebellion. And a bunch of theologians who've read him too and have their own ways of dealing with him. But I think to give people sort of a stepping off point of like, hey, where do I go to read more and talk in that similar language? I think Camus is a great place to start.
I too love Camus. So I will certainly not argue with you on that. Yeah. And I mean, absolutely. And I like to tell people, because I have a similar, but I mean, obviously very different, but similar in the sense that as a Jew speaking out against what the state created supposedly for me is doing, committing this genocide, it's very important. And I do think it's also important to use Judaism to combat that and not step away from Judaism, but to recognize that in our history, there is a staunch history of anti-Zionism as well. And that Israel, like the actual word Israel, means to struggle with God. And that our goal, our job, our mandate really is to be a part of that struggle in whatever iterations that shows up in, and to always be on the side of the oppressed. And so I think that in whatever stories we tell and whatever myths we tell, there is always going to be space to struggle against the oppressor and to not take the side of the oppressor. And I think that is our mandate, perhaps now more than ever, but although yeah. Everyone says now more than ever, I guess, every time.
But that language of responsibility is so keen. And I think it also involves us realizing the communities which we have like been shaped by and also inhabit in some insider sense. Everything you've articulated, Eleanor, is a perspective that is very much born up from within, but then also has a hearing without, in the same way that this book represents. I'm a son of this house. Like, I don't have to keep going down this road, but like I won't. Just the ways that evangelicalism has shaped me for better or worse. And I'm not cutting off that past, but I am changing. And so there's all of that way. So I was particularly moved by your willingness to sort of articulate those differences with language. And I think it just is a really good place to land, because it's the language of responsibility and the acts of naming things. And I say it in the book that our words build worlds, mm-hmm. and those worlds of healing or harm. And so a lot of it depends on the stories we tell and the words that we speak.
Amen, if I may say. folks, please do check out the book. It's a beautiful read. And again, it's from the evangelical space and experience, but it's certainly not only for evangelicals. And I, as somebody who's clearly not, got a lot out of this. And I think it's very important to understand not just our present, but how we got here and how perhaps we might get out. The book, again, is called Reality in Ruins: How Conspiracy Theory Became an American Evangelical Crisis. Jared, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us, and thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you, Eleanor.
You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio, and I'm your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield. Coming up next, I sit down with Freedom of the Press Foundation's Chief of Advocacy, Seth Stern, to dig into some of the most recent and egregious threats to the First Amendment. That's coming up right now, so please stay with us. Thanks, everyone, for joining us at the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I am your co-host, Eleanor Goldfield, and we're very glad to welcome back to the program Seth Stern, who's the Chief of Advocacy over at Freedom of the Press Foundation. Seth, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So, Seth, we have a lot to get to today, unfortunately, but I'd like to start with the Prairie Land 9 trial, and we're not going to get into all the details because that would be at least a full hour show on its own, but Seth, you've written about this at The Intercept, as has Jeremy Busby, the incarcerated journalist who we've also had on the show. So I recommend folks go check out those articles for a more in-depth look. But I want to start here talking to you about some of the verdicts. One, that jurors convicted 8 defendants on material support for terrorism charges for wearing black clothes. Prosecutors claim that the use of black bloc clothing, which is not a thing, was an Antifa tactic that assisted in the shooting of an officer. Defendants were also convicted of providing material support to terrorists, rioting, and explosives charges related to fireworks. But wait, it gets worse. Zines about anti-fascism, anarchy, and organizing were treated as tools of terrorism rather than protected free speech. So Seth, can you walk us through some of these remarkably disturbing and extreme verdicts?
Sure. So the only actual crime that may have been committed was that supposedly one of the protesters fired a gun and hit a police officer who was responding to the protest. The officer quickly recovered. I think he was hospitalized for a couple of hours. Subsequently, though, instead of prosecuting the shooter, the authorities decided to prosecute as many people as they possibly could by creating this conspiracy framework. And the advantage to prosecutors of imagining up something like an Antifa is that then you don't actually need to prove a conspiracy to fire the gun at this particular officer, because there was none. It, by all accounts, is something that sort of happened spontaneously, much to the dismay of most of the protesters who were there to attend a protest, make their voices heard, and go home and get on with their lives, not to get caught up in any sort of criminal case. But once you've got this so-called terrorist group, you can string together theories by which even people who had nothing to do with the shooting itself allegedly have to do with the imaginary group. And you can, you know, loop them in that way. So there you, as you said, something like making up a uniform that this group wears and wearing that uniform. I guess I'm wearing that uniform. I'm wearing black. Wearing that uniform makes you a member of the terrorist group if you're with the supposed group at the time that they commit a crime. That's enough. In the case involving the zines, there was a particular person, Daniel Sanchez Estrada, who wasn't even there at the protest. His wife was. He had some anarchist zines in his home that he moved after the protest. I don't know why he moved them. Maybe he did move them because he was afraid after he heard there had been a shooting that cops would use those zines against him, but that's a comment on the lawlessness of the cops and the prosecutors more than anything on Sanchez Estrada's end. All he did was have constitutionally protected literature. And if he was concerned that that would be used against him or his wife in a criminal case, his concerns have now been validated because indeed they were. Now, the zines he had were, for anyone who's ever read a zine, nothing unusual. They're political theory, they're essays, some interesting, some not. You know, they're just like any other piece of literature you pick up. But not a single one of them had anything to do with a protest in Texas on July 4th, let alone shooting a police officer at said protest. They were, you know, years old zines, collections of essays commonly available. But again, by looping everything under this Antifa umbrella, the authorities were able to make the case that his possession of Antifa literature, which apparently zines are just like black shirts are Antifa uniforms, that evidenced involvement in this organization that was ultimately responsible for the officer being shot. And his moving that literature while knowing that his wife was at this protest and might come under investigation due to that is concealment of evidence. You know, the question is evidence of what? Having zines is not evidence of a crime. Reading the same literature that a criminal reads is not evidence of the crime. So is that where they were going? Well, the shooter also had similar zines. You know, so what? I'm sure a lot of stuff I've read has been read by criminals. I mean, it's so ridiculous. Like, you don't even know where to start. And you mentioned Jeremy's article. What he added to that is that this has been happening in prisons for the longest. People have been put in solitary, had their sentences enhanced, otherwise been penalized because literature, sort of anti-authoritarian literature that guards worry might incite some sort of rebellion, has been found in their cells. And I would argue that it's unconstitutional and downright awful in that setting too. But the argument would be that, well, people who are incarcerated pose these unique risks. They have lessened constitutional rights as opposed to people on the outside. There is a more legitimate fear of imminent lawlessness. Whatever excuses might have been used to justify that on the inside are proven to be just excuses, because now we see when the opportunity arises, the exact same thing happening on the outside.
Yeah, and I want to get to another issue that we've seen happening in prisons. But before I get to that, I want to just ask about the precedent here, because, of course, the First Amendment or any policy or legislation is only as good as its enforcement. If this sets precedent that overrules and overrides the First Amendment, what good is the First Amendment, and what kind of precedent does this set for somebody who, I don't know, reads?
Right. Yeah. Not a great one. Not a great one. It creates a glaring exception to basic First Amendment freedoms for anything that prosecutors can tie to whatever they consider to be terrorism, whatever they consider to be Antifa, which was never is not the standard under which the First Amendment operates. The only sort of violence or lawlessness exceptions to the First Amendment have to do with incitement of imminent violence. There is nothing imminent about reading political theory that hypothetically might radicalize you, hypothetically might cause you to develop anti-government positions, that hypothetically might one day lead you to take violent action against the government, which I guess is the domino effect that prosecutors would point to develop a theory like this. Lots of people read anti-government literature. That's the whole point of the First Amendment. We don't need a First Amendment to protect the right to read pro-government literature. The government isn't coming after you for that. They want you to do that. So if there is to be a constitutional right that presumably was the right to read, to read, write, possess stuff the government doesn't want you to have. So yes, this the precedent would be extremely damaging. My strong hope is that it will be overruled on appeal. And there are plenty of reasons to be somewhat optimistic that'll happen, both that, you know, even these days, the idea that wearing a shirt or possessing zines can get you imprisoned for terrorism or related charges is absurd. There were also a lot of procedural issues with the case. The judge disqualified counsel for arbitrary reasons on more than one occasion and did a lot of other, you know, very questionable stuff in the course of administering the case. So there are procedural and substantive reasons to overrule this case. I hope that'll happen. But the thing is that the government has said this will not be the last time they attempt this. There are going to be more quote unquote terrorism prosecutions based on constitutionally protected speech. And this wasn't the first one either. This is in many ways reminiscent of the Cop City case in Atlanta. Just that one failed where this one succeeded.
Yeah, absolutely. Contextualizing where we are is super important. And I want to move now because you mentioned Jeremy Busby and incarcerated incarcerated folks trying to tell the story of their lived reality. And a couple of weeks ago were the Oscars. And although it didn't win, The Alabama Solution was up for Best Documentary. And it's a film made using contraband cell phones. Quoting now from an article that you co-authored in Inquest, quote, the film exposes overcrowding, violence, medical neglect, and suspicious deaths that the Alabama Department of Corrections worked hard to conceal. It shows guards sleeping while on the clock as incarcerated people overdose and pools of blood left in cells after violent assaults, end quote. According to the advocacy organization Unlock the Box, at least 122,000 people are right now in solitary confinement in the U.S. For their journalism, for their filmmaking, those folks involved, Raul Poole, Robert Earl Council, and Melvin Ray, were transferred to extreme solitary confinement at Alabama's Kilby Prison in January. And of course, this retaliation is nothing new. Again, we spoke to Jeremy Busby on this show about it. He's one of the co-authors of this article as well. And so I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the status of these filmmakers as of today. We're recording this on March 19th, so folks know. And what the kind of violent censorship we're seeing in prisons could tell us about the future of our press freedoms on the outside.
Yeah, the last information I got about the filmmakers, and I can't be absolutely certain that it's current, is that one of them was still in solitary. It is possible that one or two of the others are no longer in solitary, but these situations are fluid, and I don't want to speak about that with absolute certainty. The point really is that very likely in retaliation for capturing the footage that allowed for the creation of this Oscar-nominated film exposing abuses, three people were placed in solitary confinement, retaliated against, punished. I would note, for another example of people placed in solitary confinement, getting back to the Prairie Land case, many of those defendants leading up to trial were placed in solitary confinement. That as well was likely related to the fact that there were terrorism charges against them that allowed the argument to be made, that allowed prison authorities to say, well, these people are a threat, these people are dangerous, they need to be placed in solitary. Didn't matter that the basis for the terrorism charges was black clothing or whatever it may have been. The solitary confinement is an enormous problem that is overused and that experts say is torture. And rather than being used to protect other incarcerated people, which I suppose is the stated purpose, it is used to retaliate and to break people's spirits and to prevent people from speaking to others, exposing abuses, organizing to combat abuses that are so commonplace in our prison system. One point that article made is that whereas those three individuals were punished for using contraband phones, someone else who recorded abuses illegally, Guan Heng, who was a Chinese whistleblower who obviously broke Chinese law to expose Uyghur internment camps in China and fled to the United States. He was almost deported recently. He was held by ICE, and his footage had helped BuzzFeed, win Pulitzers for its reporting, similar to how these three folks in Alabama helped produce an Oscar-nominated film. And in Guan Heng's case, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, plenty of other outlets, plenty of other mainstream voices came to his defense. Even Marco Rubio reportedly came to his defense initially. None of these people, none of these voices on the political side or the media side were concerned with the fact that he had broken Chinese law to get the footage he got. Everyone sort of understood that it's an end justifies the means situation, that if you're able to expose abuses or help journalists expose abuses, we can overlook the fact that you recorded the footage contrary to applicable rules. Nobody has the same sympathy for these incarcerated folks, though. They broke the rules, too. Wasn't because they wanted to break the rules, not because they were looking for a reason to break the rules. It's because there's no transparency in the prison system, just like there's often no transparency from the Chinese government or from our own government. The only way they could expose what was going on was through the use of contraband cell phones, and so they did. So it's disturbing that we have this double standard, of course. The other takeaway from the Alabama Solution, for me at least, is at what point do journalists on the outside need to get more comfortable with surreptitious news gathering methods? As I said, the reason that the folks in the Alabama solution had to go that route is because all other options were foreclosed. They couldn't get in the front door, so they had to go in the back. They can't just file FOIA requests or ask for interviews with prison staff. That's not how it works. So they found another way. Well, journalists on the outside can't really file FOIA requests or expect to get a meaningful response to FOIA requests when FOIA offices are being depleted and FOIA officers are being fired for complying with FOIA requests. Journalists on the outside can't really expect to get answers from personnel when they're being barred from press conferences, told that soliciting information from non-authorized personnel might be a crime. That's the official position of the Pentagon pursuant to a brief filed last week in defense of Pete Hegseth's press pledge policies. That's the Pentagon said in the New York Times lawsuit over Pete Hegseth's policy that in order to cover the Pentagon, you need to sign a pledge saying you are not going to publish information you're not authorized to publish. They said it is not criminal solicitation if you ask personnel, PR flacks, who are authorized to release it, questions. But if you ask unauthorized people questions, that's criminal solicitation. That's the official position of the federal government. So when you're going against that kind of censorship, maybe you do need to take a page out of the journalist from the Alabama Solutions book and try some other methods that in another time might have been frowned upon.
Yeah, I mean, if journalism is a crime, do you stop doing journalism or do you become a criminal? And I want to get into another piece from an FPF newsletter that recently you sent out. The public deserves to know when Iran war reporting is stifled. And in it, you note that journalists covering the U.S. and Israel's war on Iran should be telling their audiences not only what they know, but what they were prevented from finding out and by whom. And you just mentioned, of course, Hegseth's oath thing, you know, proving their loyalty to Trump and co. And, you know, basically, this really gets to kind of a core of corporate media, right? I mean, I recall years ago, like over a decade, there was a roundtable discussion on some corporate media outlet that said, when should we strike Syria? Not if, because the if was already a foregone conclusion, right? It was just like the question of when. And this was considered the whole entire spectrum of debate, right? And so I wondered if you could get into this a little bit, and we're kind of getting into like the old Rumsfeld's word salad of the known unknowns, the unknown knowns knowns. But like, we don't know what we don't know. And in this case, the lack of knowledge could literally be apocalyptic. And the journalistic malpractice that's supporting this is in these times, perhaps the most grotesque. And I was wondering if you could get into a little bit of this and the state of corporate media that's keeping this kind of information from us.
Right, right. Well, the point that I was attempting to make in that article is that oftentimes when gathering a story, corporate media or otherwise, reporters are prevented from getting the full story in any number of ways. It could be the government, it could be Pete Hegseth, it could be their editors or their corporate parents, whatever conglomerate they're operating under. It could be threats, could be denials of public records requests, it could be any number of things. And what the news consumer, the reader, viewer ultimately gets is the news that the reporter was able to obtain, but without that context, without the context that this might be a way bigger story. I tried to find out if this was a way bigger story, but I was thwarted from doing so in the following ways. Journalists don't want to publish that for a number of reasons. Word counts, sure. But beyond that, people don't want to admit their failings. People don't want to admit that they weren't able to get the story they wanted and that their deadline came along and, you know, this is all they got. And also, oftentimes, all they got might seem in and of itself to be a notable story. So why not take the credit for getting a notable story without beating up on yourself for what you were unable to get? So, you know, there are a lot of different contributors, I think. Also, there's sort of this assumption that the public isn't really interested in the ins and outs of the news gathering process. That's inside baseball. That's navel gazing. You know, you're going to bore people if you include that. I think it's time to reevaluate that mentality. Press freedom is part of the story now. You can't, whatever concern you might have about it being awkward to talk about your own role as a journalist, it is the story. We're reading about it every day. It's subject to attacks from the government on an ongoing basis of increasing creativity and absurdity. So you can't avoid writing about it. My suggestion is, in addition to writing about it as a separate news story when Pete Hegseth announces his new policy, or as an editorial or an op-ed, integrate it into the main narrative as you report. Talk about the FOIAs that were denied. Talk about what you were excluded by the Israeli censor from seeing as part of the primary story. Don't put it in a box that only those interested are going to find. You got to make clear that whatever information people are getting about this war is highly censored, and that you're giving them what you're able to give them, but that there's way more to the story. People deserve to know that, and I don't think it's going to reflect poorly on the journalists who are transparent about it. In fact, I think it'll earn them respect from their readers. So that especially with the level of censorship we're seeing now, needs to be part of the process. When you talk about corporate media, I don't expect that CNN's going to start doing that, but I would like to see more independent journalists do that.
And I think you also point out in this piece that it's worth highlighting the risks that journalists take as well, like the Espionage Act, how frequently in the past couple of decades that's been thrown around, and understanding that, you know, self-censorship is rampant. And so journalists being honest, not just about what they couldn't get, but the risks they're taking, I think, is also important, because it highlights how important journalism, real journalism, is, and how subversive it is in times like these. So, Seth, thank you so much for walking us through this this cesspool of attacks on freedom of expression, freedom of the press. Folks, do check out the work that FPF, Freedom of the Press Foundation, does. It's really important, particularly in these times. So, Seth, thank you so much for coming back on the show, and thanks for the work that you do.
Thanks. Anytime. We want to smash, crash.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your producer and co-host, Eleanor Goldfield, along with my co-host and executive producer, Mickey Huff. For more information about all the things that the project does, from the classroom to the radio waves, please check out projectcensored.org. I'd also like to remind listeners that the views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Project Censored. This broadcast is intended for educational purposes as part of our mission to promote critical media literacy, independent journalism, and civic engagement. We aim to foster thoughtful dialogue and encourage listeners to think critically about the information that they receive from all media sources. Project Censored is a 501c3 nonprofit organization and does not endorse or oppose any candidate for public office. We have a lot of tools, resources, and information over at our website. Again, that's projectcensored.org. Please also follow us on social media at Project Censored. As always, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the